Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Professor Yuntu Wang. He is a professor of English at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And we're interested in him in North Carolina because of his brand new book. It's called Inseparable, and it's the story of the original Siamese twins and their rendezvous with American history. Professor Wang, welcome to Who's Talking.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you said I can call you Yuntu. Yuntu.
Yes.
And you will correct me when I get off base on terms of the pronunciation. Well, that reminds me that before we talk about the story of the twins, your story is fascinating. You grew up in China, went to the University of Peking before you came to the United States. Tell us about your background.
Well, I grew up in a very small town in southeastern China. And, I started learning English like all other Chinese kids, you know, studying in middle school. But I had a somewhat unusual experience or encounter, when I was 11. I was playing with a kind of old battered transistor radio that used to belong to my grandfather. And in those years, I grew up in the early 1970s and the waning days of Mao's China. And in those days, really, every household actually has a, rather than a TV, we had a transistor radio, which enabled you to listen to all sorts of news or, you know, from literally from all over the world. But we also had to be very careful not listening to so-called politically subversive radio programs. But anyway, so one day I was playing with it, and then I came to a frequency when I was turning the dial up and down. And it turns out to be a Voice of America. It was coming from, I guess, was sponsored by the State Department at the time in the Cold War era. And I had no clue, you know, this was actually mostly propaganda, but I was learning English from it. And so I learned a great deal of English from all these programs, although I could have sent my parents to jail for listening to
programs. Is that right?
Programs. But it was a small town, and I was, you know, I would usually huddle down, like in a dark room, you know.
What did your parents? What was your father? What was his?
I came from a doctor's family. Generations of Chinese doctors, and they're actually all cracks, as I would call. Anyway, so nowadays students call me Dr. Huang, and I feel like quite strange about it because Dr. Huang means my father.
That's your dad, yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, I ended up going to Peking University, partly because of, you know, all those years of listening to VOA, so I was an English major, and at the time I thought my future was pretty kind of straightforward and certain to some extent, that I will graduate, and then I was, you know, from Peking University, and I will stay on as a graduate student and then a professor of English literature, apparently. But unfortunately, in my sophomore year, the student protest broke out in 1989, and which, as you know, led to government crackdown, martial law, you know, massacre of civilians and students.
Tiananmen Square is what we.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Now know it is. We know at the Tiananmen Square. You know.
And so you're a student This is your formative years.
Sophomore at Peking University, and all of us, all the students, of course, participated in those 2 months of protests and marching and sitting and everything, hunger strike. So that tragedy really broke my hope for the country, and that's when I decided to leave when I graduate, and I did. So in the summer of 1991. I came to the United States, landing, of all places, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So I'm a Southerner from the get-go.
I can tell from your accent. You've got a deep Alabama drawl.
Well,
and so we're going to talk about this. If you joined us late, I'm talking to Professor Wang about his new book called Inseparable about the Siamese twins who spent most of their lives in North Carolina. But you're one of the special aspects of Professor Wang's treatment of the twins is that, like them, he is an Asian immigrant to the United States and to the South. How did you get out? I thought it was difficult even in those days to...
Yes, it was, actually. There were a lot of strict policies because, you know, we got basically free education from the government, and we were supposed to at least work for the government at least for 5 years after graduation. So I had to jump through a lot of loopholes and everything, you know, to get out. And at the time, I swore I'll never go back again. But you know, 20 years or so later, you know, China has definitely changed. No, although not always in the way we were hopeful. So that experience, you know, leaving your motherland, you know, country, coming to a new place, and especially certainly in the South as an Asian American, and that really made me, you know, although this is, you know, my story and the Siamese twins story, you know, it was what, like 150 years apart. But the South, you know, how should I put it, remains, you know, charming in some aspects. And
that, the dark side, you know, there's a dark side to our, that I can say that. Well, you're a Southerner now, too, you can say it, but we love the South, but we know that there's a dark side that
makes it. Well, yes, that's why I say it's charming, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. And I still have very, you know, kind of nostalgic about the South because of its deep history, and of course the South is full of problems, and the same as with California or New England for that matter. And I really enjoy, you know, going around, moving around the country, and getting to know different places and its deep history and everything. And I feel I'm fortunate, actually, to have landed in the South. You know, at the beginning. Otherwise, I guess, if I had landed in New York City or any of the big cities, I would never have been able to, you know, spend more time in the South and to know a bit more about, you know, the different aspects of this country, right?
Well, I could talk to you about your experience, and one day maybe I can do that. But I persuaded you to come visit with us here in Chapel Hill through the magic of telephone on the basis of your telling us about your new book, Inseparable,
right,
about the Siamese twins. So tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book and what you wound up with.
Right. As you know, that my last book was on Charlie Chan, this kind of funny aphorism-spouting Chinese detective from Honolulu. And he was both real and fictional, because the story was based on a real Cantonese cop in Honolulu. And in writing that book, I, you know, dived, you know, into the early history of Chinese immigration to the United States, and I described, you know, certain stereotypes or biases against them. And Chen and Ang were one of the early examples of American, you know, biases against Asians. And so I did a little research in Chang An's story. And so in the process of that, I grew, you know, fascination with that story. And I thought I'd better write about them and did more research into their history. And
what is it about that? What is it about that that hooked you first, other than that they, like you, or were Asian immigrants to the United States?
Well, the first thing that hooked me, like I said, was they were one of the early immigrants to this country. They came before the Civil War, way before even the influx of Chinese immigrants to this country after Gold Rush and, you know, 49ers. And they were really trailblazers. And but also, their unique physicality and what they went through really, I think, you know, kind of blows apart what we understand to be kind of a human being, for instance. What is their experience? So imagine, I mean, if you're tied to somebody else and you have to do everything together. So from that perspective, you know, what we often cherish as the cornerstone of liberal democracy, so-called individualism, right, that live your own life and pursue your own happiness and the freedom and everything. To them, this is, you know, that's completely different. And how they have to go through their entire life or lives to negotiate, you know, with all these things, I thought that's something quite fascinating.
Well, we need to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you to sort of give us a summary story of the Siamese twins from the time they were born all the way through the things that you cover in your book. So if you join us late, I'm visiting with Professor Hunter Wang, and we're talking about his book, Inseparable. And it's a story of the Siamese twins, and he and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Professor Hunter Wang. He is a professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara. But more than that, he's the author of a number of books, including, as he reviewed with us earlier, a book about the wonderful Chinese-American detective Charlie Chan. And that has led him to write a book about a couple of Asian immigrants who are more familiar to us in North Carolina, Chang and Ng, the famous Siamese twins. And your book covers it all. Is it possible to give a short summary of the highlights of the lives of Chang and Ng? Can you?
I can certainly try after having written a book that was just, you know, quite long. Yes, they were born in Siam, now known as Thailand. They were called Siamese twins, but actually, you know, when they were younger, still living in Siam, they were actually called Chinese twins. And so, because their father was Chinese and their mother was half Chinese, half Siamese, which will make them three quarters of Chinese.
Well, were they? Anyway, did they? They view themselves as Chinese, or did they speak Chinese?
Yes, they spoke Chinese.
Or a dialect
Chinese
of Chinese.
Dialect. And one of the things, you know, as an author, right, writing, digging history, and sometimes you find, you get lucky and find certain things. And the one thing I'm very proud of, as far as research is concerned, that I was able to track down the contract, a handwritten contract they signed with Abel Coffin, the American ship captain, who eventually, you know, brought them to the United States. On the day of their departure, actually on April Fool's Day, April 1st, 1829, they were 17 at the time, and they signed this handwritten contract, and they sent their names in Chinese, and that's also their witness, who will be traveling with them to the United States and later England, also signed his name in Chinese. So that's how I got to know. You know, all these years I was thinking, Chang and Ang, what do they stand for, really? And I was able to see, you know.
You have the real Chinese character. Characters. There's been a lot of debate about that. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Written in their own hands. And as for how, you know, yes, you're right. A lot of biographers speculated as to how the name Chang and Ang came about. And so anyway, they were tied together by a band of flesh, you know, at birth. At their birth, the band itself was about 4 inches in length. But over the years, it stretched to about 5.5 inches length. Anyway, so they were growing up, you know, like healthy Chinese boys in Thailand. And one day, they were, you know, sort of so-called discovered, because a traveling Scottish businessman by the name of Robert Hunter saw them swimming in the river. In the dark, he thought he saw something kind of, you know, mysterious, a mythological creature, really, you know, coming out of the water. And coming closer, he realized there were, you know, two boys joined together. And that's when he realized that he could take them, you know, out of Thailand and, you know, bring them to the West, as a freak show, and he realized that you know the opportunity to make money, and so he later partnered with this American ship captain Abel Coffin from New England, and brought them the twins to the United States and exhibited them, But the boys, you know, were very savvy. That's one thing which fascinates me about their story, was that they were very savvy, independent entertainers and businessmen. They're very, you know, acute business sense. When they turned 21, they were able to break free, you know, break from the contract they signed with Abel Coffin or Robert Hunter, and became, you know, basically managed their own show. And they made a lot of money, although it was very hard work. They were hit, you know, every town, every little nook and cranny of this country. And sometimes they make a lot of money in one town, but sometimes they barely, you know, will break even in another. But eventually they were able to accumulate enough wealth. And when they were about 28, 1839, they chose a very remote spot in this country, meaning western North Carolina, and settled down first in this place called Trap Hill, as you know, in Wilkes County, and later on moved to Mount Airy. And there, they, you know, in Wilkes County, they married, managed to marry two white sisters, right? And then set up household later on in Mount Airy, and had 21 children. And they also went through Civil War, and we can also talk about that.
Well, tell us about, quickly. So you're doing such a great job.
So they went through Civil War, and they sent their, they were staunch Southerners, you know, supporting the Confederacy. And they sent their two sons, you know, first sons, Christopher and Stephen, to the battlefield. Both sons were injured and wounded and captured by the Union troops, but at least they were able to come home alive later on. And they lost everything because they became slave owners prior to the Civil War, and they lost, the twins lost all the, at the peak of their wealth, they owned about 32 slaves, and they lost all of them. And they also lost, I guess, out of patriotic, you know, sense, they actually invested in Confederate bonds, and they lost it all, of course, after the war. And so they were broke after the Civil War. They had no choice but to go on the road again. And but Chang suffered a stroke while traveling. They were traveling on the road, and they came home, got a little better, but eventually Chang died in sleep one early morning. And Eng died a few hours later, and that's, you know, that is really the story. Although, you know, I also tell a kind of a long but very interesting kind of afterlife story about them, including their autopsies, but also, you know, the place where they lived and died, and how their legacy, you know, lived on.
So I think North Carolinians, is it possible to visit the grave of the, did they get buried here in North Carolina?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Well, the greatest thing is, you know, as I write it in the, toward the end of the book, I did two road trips to North Carolina. One time I drove all the way from California to North Carolina. I mean, I did it for two reasons. One, that I really enjoy road trips, you know, driving in the United States because it's open country.
Now, are you
and
by yourself?
The other reason is that...
Are you by yourself, or you got a traveling companion? By yourself?
No, I love driving by myself, you know, just, and you know, long drive. But the other reason is that I wanted to experience, because they, the Chang'an, you know, Chang'an literally hit every town, you know, every little village, you know. So I wanted to experience that. But anyway, I got there. But on my second trip... I gave a talk in Tennessee, and then I rented a car and I drove across the state lines and came to Mount Airy, first one Wilkesboro, and then Mount Airy. You know, for North Carolinians, you know, Mount Airy today, as you know, is the birthplace of Andy Griffith. But not many people know, the same town, you know, it's the same town where the twins had lived. And their farm, their home estate, although it has been split apart because of the highway construction, but their farm is still there and is still, you know, owned by their descendants. And today actually has been turned into, quote-unquote, Maybury Campground. So it's for camping. And I spent one night there because I'm Chinese. I always want to know, you know, the spirit of the place that I'm describing, where stories took place, even though, like I said, it's about 150 years, you know, later. You can still tell a little about what we call feng shui, right?
Yeah.
So I spent, I foolishly spent one night there because, and, you know, I'm not an outdoors person. I had was a rental car, and spending, you know, one night up in the mountain in a rental car, as I, you know, discovered, it was quite a mistake, but at least I went through the night, and I described all that experience, you know, toward the end of my book.
No, that's a great chapter in your book, and I enjoyed reading it. The entrepreneurial spirit that you've just mentioned about the twins were both smart and ambitious and creative in terms of, and had to be, to make money, but that spirit survives with the Bunker family, and they've taken part of the Bunker land and, as you say, created a campground. And so they're making money on the land that the twins bought for their farm. An amazing story. Well, you did an outstanding job of summarizing the twins' life. And so let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about some of the things that you learned about them during that life. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Professor Junta Huang. He's the author of a new book on our Siamese twins. It's called Inseparable. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm learning more about one of my favorite topics, and that's the original Siamese twins, Chang and Ing. And to we have the current expert on that topic, Professor Junta Huang, who is the author of a brand-new book called Inseparable, with the subtitle The Original Siamese Twins and Their Rendezvous with American History. And Professor Huang, you've done a great job of giving us a summary of the twins' lives, but your book is full of stories about what happened to them along the way. And tell us a couple of your favorite twins' stories.
I think what guaranteed their success, you know, as businessmen, was not just their, you know, acute, you know, shrewdness, but also their remarkable ability to entertain the audience and their interaction. So they were, despite their English at the beginning when they first came to this country, but they're also very quick learners. They learned to play chess, play, you know, all sorts of games, but they also know how to crack jokes, and it took advantage of the occasion to give the audience, or the visitors rather, you know, their money's worth in some ways. For example, one time they saw, you know, a one-eyed man in the audience. So they went ahead and said, we should refund half of your money because you only have one eye, you know, cannot see as much as we do. I mean, of course, it's sort of like a joke, but also kind of very kind of human touch there, right? But also they also very, very great sense of humor. And because, you know, they were regarded as freaks, and people will try to, and you know, people make fun of them or you know, look down upon them and everything, and they know exactly how to fight back. And so one time there was a priest who tried to grill them about heaven and earth, and so this priest asked them, like, do you know where you're going when you die? And they said, up there, you know, pointing upwards. And the priest then asked them, do you know where I'm going when I die? And they pointed downwards and said, down there, just to, you know, kind of make fun of the person who's interrogating them, right? Because they are very intelligent, right? And at one time, it was a small town in Ohio, in a small village, and they were grilled by a bunch of villagers. And one of them asked the twins, like, do you guys ever talk, you know, when you're alone? And Eng said, me, never alone. Because they're tied together, right? Because what we understand as being alone, you know, they took it very differently. And then And then, so the same person asked them again, like, why don't you talk then? And Chang said, no news. Between them, there's really no news. And then somebody noticed that it's Chang who will pocket all the money, you know, for the missions fee. And so they asked Aang, like, why does your brother pocket all the money? And Aang said, well, me rob him tonight, you know, me good pickpocket. And so they're very kind of, you know, they like to crack jokes. But on the other hand, they also got into, you know, occasionally got into fist fights with people who, you know, when, you know, I guess crossed the red line.
You're going to tell them. This is an interesting story in your book. You know, we're in the middle of a controversy here in North Carolina and really all over the country about the gerrymandering of our
right.
Political
Absolutely.
Districts. And you have a story that connects the
right,
Siamese
right, yes.
twins to
at least
the,
by name or
yeah.
remotely by blood, yes. So they got into, yes, you're right. So this isn't in the early years. They were still owned by Abel Coffin, and so the one it was hot summer, and at least they worked like slaves for their owners, but they were at least allowed like a weekend one time, and they were trying to spend that weekend in the woods and in Massachusetts. And they wanted to go hunting, but they were chased like wild beasts by what we call, you know, paparazzis of the 19th century.
So people...
Because people are curious, crowd following them like a beast, you know. But they just want to be alone and do some hunting. But the folks would not go away, and they got really mad. And eventually there was this guy by the name of Jerry, right?
Eldridge Jerry or something like that.
Eldridge Jerry, yes. And he's actually related to the other Eldridge Jerry, who's the former governor of Massachusetts. And that person was the guy who gave us, you know, our democracy, the great term, gerrymandering, really.
And well,
what he did in Massachusetts when he was a governor and later on as a politician. But anyway, this remote cousin of that gerrymandering Jerry and had an encounter with the twins, and because he insulted the twins and said, because he was one of the, one of the people who had been following the twins all day. And the twins said, if you guys don't go away, I'm going to shoot you. And this Jerry guy, I think he's called a Colonel Jerry, and he said, I dare you. And, of course, the twins were just, it was a threat. And But Colonel Jerry made a mistake of calling them liars since they didn't actually shoot them. Since he called them liars, they turned around and was going to fight him. And Colonel Jerry threw a stone at the twins and I guess hit one of the twins. And the twins wheeled around and fired. Unfortunately, there was no bullet in the gun.
Mm.
And as a result, that they were the twins were actually were fined $200 for that on the second day in court. And so that was quite one of the incidents. Their run-ins with law. And they'd have a number of that kind of encounters. Later on in Alabama, my home state, in this cotton town, on the border of Tennessee and Alabama, they got into trouble again. But at that time, they were already on their own, breaking free from their owners. And this was a small village, and they were entertaining basically the entire town, which turned out to see them at this village inn, and sitting among the audience was a country doctor, and the doctor, trying to flex his medical muscle, he said, how about let me examine you guys, of course, all the folks there, yeah, let's do this, get our money's worth. But the twins at that point, they already traveled on their own for a number of years, and they have been poked and examined by world-renowned doctors, you know, in at Harvard, in Edinburgh, and everything. So they said, you know, they felt like, who are you, like a country doctor? Well, I know we don't want to go through that humiliation again. But of course, the doctor said, well, if you won't let me examine you, it means that you guys are imposters. You know, you're fake. And that, you know, didn't end well. They got into fights and everything. The twins, you know, barely managed to escape, you know, alive. After the whole town, you know, turned out to try to beat them, and they got into trouble, got a little fine for that as well. Because the idea that the imposter was important, because, you know, we are talking about the age of Barnum, like P.T. Barnum, humbugs.
And I tell you what,
there were a lot of, you know, hoaxes like that as part of the freak show.
We need to take a quick, Professor Huang, we need to take a quick break, but this is a good break because you and I both are interested in P.T. Barnum. Maybe we can come back and talk to him about him and the twins after a short break. Professor Huang, the author of a new book about the Siamese twins called Inseparable, he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor Junta Wan, who is a professor at the University of California in Santa Barbara. More than that, he's the author about two famous North Carolinians, Chang and Ing Bunker. And you've just done such a great job of, at least for me, getting me excited about these Siamese twins again. One of the things in your book that interested me was the encounter that the twins had with P.T. Barnum, and we know about Barnum as a exhibitor, as a promoter. But the twins had always avoided, you know, working for other people. They didn't want to be What? Tell us why they didn't want to be with Barnum, and then what led them to go under his tutelage for a while.
Well, first of all, let's talk about Barnum and why Barnum didn't get along with the twins as much as he would like to own them. And, Barnum, first of all, he was not the one who discovered the twins, and he always held grudges against them. Mm. You know, he liked to, what he called, Barnumize, you know, all his so-called freaks, right? So Barnum's freaks. And he would love to keep the twins, claim the twins are part of his collection, and but he couldn't get it, because the twins were too independent.
Mark, for so those, excuse me, but the Barnum, well known, we know the name, but I mean, he had these collection of, we'd call them odd people or freaks, or like Tom Thumb.
American Museum. His American Museum was the Disneyland of, you know, 19th century America. And with the recent, you know, blockbuster movie starring Hugh Jackman as P.T. Barnum, in which actually the twin, Chang and Ang, had what I call like unsung, you know, roles. They appeared, you know, played by two Asian American actors, but they didn't have speaking roles. And but the Barnum, Chang and Ang, they came to America and became showmen before really the appearance of. There was about a decade earlier than the rise of Barnum, and also the rise of those big circus, you know, circuses and caravans and everything. And so the twins were really independent, you know, entertainers. They were the trailblazers, literally, of American entertainment. And so Barnum didn't like them, like I said. First of all, he didn't discover them. And secondly, the twins were very independent, and they cannot be manipulated, and they drive a really hard bargain. And Barnum didn't like that. But they did have, you know, I guess, two occasions, what I would like to call, like, marriage of convenience. So they partnered with Barnum. First time before the Civil War, and second time after the Civil War. And the twins didn't like Barnum because, you know, Barnum was the prince of humbugs. The twins could see through, and before the Civil War, the twins did exhibit, you know, at the American Museum, along with actually two of their children at the museum, and they felt very humiliated because Barnum basically put the twins and their sons right next to this family which Bonham claimed were like Aboriginals from Africa, but they were not.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bonham is very, as you know, as Prince of Humbugs, he loves to set up things that were actually not real, but at least he will get people, you know, to become curious, and then they pay money to see this. Even though, you know, when the visitors become skeptical, and Bonham was still able to convince them to come back and take a look again if you're not sure about what you saw. And so as he would like to say, you know, Bonham is known for saying there's a sucker born every minute, but actually, you know, it was attributed to him. But what he actually said was nothing really better. He said, you know, the American people really love to be humbugged, you know, because they like to be, you know, cheated while they were entertained. And that's really the slogan, basically. That's his business principle. And
American people like to be tricked. We enjoy being tricked. Yeah.
And have a good laugh at their own cost while they also pay for it.
Mm.
But in the case of entertainment, you know, you can talk about reality TV today and everything. So there was a lot of, I think, resonance in some ways between Bonham and the Siamese twin story and what's going on today, really. You know, how a reality TV star, you know, became president in some ways, right?
Yes.
You can talk about that. And because that's something I was very interested in, as to say, you know, how democracy is kind of a confidence game, right? And this is something Herman Melville, who, by the way, was also very interested, fascinated, you know, with the Siamese twins. And Melville saw it a long time ago, especially through the character of Bonham and also the age of freak show and everything, and to what extent, you know, people are tricked into looking at something and paying for it while being entertained, and they wouldn't mind, and because they got, or they thought they got their money's worth, for that matter. And that, interestingly, is so-called a confidence game. And a confidence here is a pun. It's, you know, on the one hand, politicians gain, you know, your confidence to vote for them. On the other hand, it's also called a con game, right? They pull a con on you. And that's the double sense of con that Bonham is very good at. Whereas the twins, however, because they're genuine, you know, if you forgive me for saying this, you know, they're regarded as genuine freaks, right, called the gems. Whereas most of the things that Bonham will put up are called the gags, right, or gaffes. And so this is the stark contrast which kind of determined that their partnership would not be successful. But they did it twice out of kind of necessity or convenience.
How did it work out?
The twins, it didn't work out very well, really. Like I said, the first time they exhibited themselves at Bonham's American Museum, and they were humiliated. They felt humiliated because they were standing right next to this hoax. And the second time, after the war, Civil War, after the twins had lost everything, and they partnered with Bonham, and who sent them actually to England. But the twins went there for also a very particular reason, because Anne's daughter, Kate, was not well, and she eventually died of TB. And she was showing symptoms, and the twins really wanted to take her to England to, you know, have the doctors there, you know, take a look at her. And so that's part of the reason they agree to partner with Bonham again, despite that humiliating experience before the war. And so that was their real purpose of going to England, you know. Unfortunately, the doctors didn't give them good diagnosis, and they came back, and their daughter, you know, died quite soon.
You have so many wonderful stories, both about the Siamese twins and their lives, but on the spine of their story, you have a wonderful social history of America during the time of the twins, and it's especially poignant for those of us who live in the South, because it intersects with the idea that these were non-white people who became white honorary right. white people when the immigration law didn't permit it. They somehow or another became American citizens and created a family that is just altogether American. It's a wonderful story, and I thank you for writing the book and then for sharing part of it with us here today.
Well, thank you. I mean, just if I can just add one more.
Yes, yes.
What I really find fascinating is that the fact they settled down in the, you know, in the South, you would imagine that, you know, New England might be more liberal and more accommodating for immigrants, but actually it's not true, right?
Yes.
It's in the South that they found home. And that's kind of, well, if I can quote Flannery O'Connor, that's what we call the Southern Gothic, right?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much, Yuen Tu Wang.
Thank
and thanks all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.